Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, episode 37.
Prepare for takeoff. Guiding you down publishing's dark alleyways.
Rubbing it in, like salt in a wound.
Expounding on the greatness of science fiction and fantasy.
Science fiction writers should try to combine the intimately human with the grandly cosmic.
Hi, this is Tobias Bakel, author of Crystal Rain.
And taking themselves way too seriously.
I've had many, many a giggle over it.
Very dramatic. Very nice.
That sounded really realistic, didn't it?
From the Singularity Audio Studios in San Diego, California, your hosts, Sean and Sam.
Then that's where you cue the cheering.
All right, we're going back to press. We're going back to press. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for the science fiction and fantasy publishing industry. My name is Sean Farrell.
I'm Sam Wins.
Hey, look who's back.
It's me.
And today we have some feedback we'll get to at the end of the show. Our author interview is the newly Hugo Award-winning author Tim Pratt, whose new novel just came out. And then we have some other things to talk about before that for publishing news. So Sam, why don't you get us started? You had a very exciting thing you went to recently.
I did. I had a fantastic Monday. I kicked off my week with a little J.K. Rowling event. You know, some of you might have heard of her. She's just this little, like, random author from England.
Yeah, sounds familiar, but I don't know really where.
Yeah.
Oh, she wrote that weird, like, Henry Popper or whatever.
Precisely. Yeah, you know, like, poorest woman in the world.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so
tell us about it.
Well, she kicked off her open book tour. She's only doing, I believe, two appearances in the U.S., one in L.A. and one in New York. Kids from schools in L.A., New Orleans, and New York applied to go to this. There was some contest. So I was in a theater with like 2,000 screaming, shivering, epileptic kids who were
so it wasn't cold.
No, they were just so excited to be there. It was fantastic, and a handful of industry folks, and I was lucky enough to be one of those peeps.
I still think it's so cool that kids get so excited about an author.
I know. Books, absolutely. You know? In fact, she touched on that when she was talking about, you know, one of the highlights of writing Harry Potter. And she said, you know, kids still tell her, and some adults too, that Harry Potter is what has gotten them to read and has taught them to love reading. And she said that's one of her greatest accomplishments. And I agree. I mean, no matter what you think about Harry Potter, she accomplished an amazing thing. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So it was, she was like a rock star, you know. In fact, they had a throne up on stage and for her to sit in, and she read from book 7 and then answered questions. In fact, I took extensive notes because, of course, there was no photography or recording equipment, you know, allowed.
Right.
There are stringent rules.
So you couldn't podcast it for us.
No. Oh, God. I wish I could have. I totally would have, but couldn't. So, yeah, I'm going to write up a little my day with J.K. Rowling or whatever, my hour and a half with J.K. Rowling, because it was only about an hour and a half long, and then they got to the signing. So since there were, you know, like 2,000 or so kids there, I'm sure she was there for many hours signing books.
I mean, yeah, even if she only signed one each.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
Yeah, she only signed one each, and they had, you know, an assembly line, so it's like clockwork. I mean, they weren't stopping and having heart-to-heart chats, but even then, and we've had Neil Gaiman and folks that draw a huge crowd at our store, and it takes them hours.
It's almost not self-defeating. That's not the way the word I mean to use, but as an author, when you can't even talk to your readers because too many people want a piece of you,
right.
That's kind of a sad thing, too.
I agree. And I think that's why they did the tour the way they did. It's just kind of a sampling of her readers, because there's no way. I mean, she could tour for literally years at a time and still not see everyone that wants to see her. You know, she could devote her life to touring. And
she could probably fill up Coliseums.
Yeah, well, this was the Kodak Theater, which is where they hold the Oscars, and it holds, you know, several thousand folks. So, and she was doing Madison Square Garden in New York. So,
oh, there you go.
And I'm sure it's full. So, so I think that's why they did just kind of a sampling of a few select cities, the most major some cities in the U.S. And, of course, I think New Orleans because of Katrina is my guess. I don't know, but to get fans to take a peek at her. And she was the one that actually approached Scholastic because she wanted to come back and see her American fans. So just wish she'd do it more often.
Yeah.
But the questions they asked were interesting. I wanted to touch on a couple. One is...
These are the kids?
Yeah, these are the kids. So what they had, the kids submitted a whole bunch of questions and then they screened the questions and selected ones that they thought were really good.
Okay.
And then those kids got to get up to the mic and ask them to her. And she answered them in full. She was very generous with her time. She seemed really nice and actually much prettier in real life than I would have expected. Not that she's not good looking. I don't mean to say that. It kind of came out wrong.
You heard it here first, folks. Yeah. That Sam on the Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing podcast. Insulting. Yeah, no.
J.K. Rowling is a dog face. No. No, she's just even prettier in person. But anywho, one of the questions one of the kids asked was, is your life, do you put your life in your plot and your characters in Harry Potter? And she said, yeah, absolutely. That Hermione was an exaggeration of her when she was younger. And that Ron is a lot like her oldest friend, Sean. Hey, Sean Farrell. No, Sean with no last name.
I always knew I was her inspiration.
You're many people's inspiration, Sean. I'm
sure. I know, it's hard. It's a curse I must bear.
Okay, moving on. she also said that Gilderoy Lockhart is based completely off of somebody that she knows, but she wouldn't name them because she doesn't want them to get it. However, right. She said this person would never guess it was them because they're so full of themselves. They would never, you know, you're so vain, right?
You probably think that song is about
yeah,
you.
Yeah, he probably think his character is about you.
Yeah. Well, I think we all know someone like that.
Yeah, Sean. He was making eyes at me. He was trying to infer me, so I had to head that off at the pass.
I wasn't really. I swear I wasn't. Actually, I really wasn't inferring.
Oh, really?
No.
You had such an... you had this look on your face. Like, oh, we all know somebody like that. Sam, wink, wink.
I was thinking about someone, but not you. Go on.
Oh, thank God. Okay. Other interesting things... she didn't come out and say that she wasn't writing anything right now, but it sounded as if she wasn't because she said she wanted to fall in love with an idea like she did with Harry Potter. So it sounded like maybe she's tootling about, but there's nothing that's really caught her attention before she writes again. But she from how she was speaking, she does intend to write again. So,
you know, and I think when you've had something as successful as this, you have to be really careful what you follow up with, or if it's not great as well, then right. All of a sudden you're a one-hit wonder who will live very comfortably for the rest of your life. But I'm sure she's thinking about that.
I'm sure. I mean, what she has to feel very, very assured of what she's writing next. I wouldn't be surprised if she takes a complete departure.
Oh, I would think so. Yeah.
And does something, you know, does like adult,
yeah.
An adult novel that isn't a fantasy, you know,
yeah.
Like... adult historical fiction or something like that. So,
but then again, George Lucas has been saying he wants to do a little independent films for like 20 years, right? And he just keeps doing more Star Wars stuff.
That's true. He did say this was his last Star Wars, though, right? Like that.
Now they're doing two television series.
Oh, that's right.
They're doing 100 episode live action series, which debuts in 2008, and a multi-season cartoon series, which is, I think, going to be on the Cartoon Network.
Cool.
Yeah.
Kind of. I mean, I actually liked the... Oh, God, I'm sorry, my Star Wars fans, you're going to shoot me for this. I can't remember the name of it, but there was a little cartoon miniseries.
The Clone Wars.
Star Wars Clone Wars. I actually liked that because it kind of tied movies 2 and 3 together. But
anyway. Yeah, and the live action series is supposed to be Luke Skywalker's childhood.
Oh, that'll be interesting.
Yeah.
I want to see sequels, though, frankly. I want to see what happens.
Me too. I want to see Harrison Ford as Han Solo.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean,
he can do indie with their kids,
all the novels written about it and
yeah.
Everything that happens with the next generation and all that. I'd like to continue the storyline.
Star Wars, the next generation.
Off the track. But I wanted to talk about what I'm reading because it does kind of tie in.
Oh, yeah, this is... Publishing News Story number 2.
Yes, indeed. It does, but it does tie into the whole Harry Potter thing. And that is, I'm reading two things right now. One is the next, well, what they're saying is the next really big thing in the young adult world. And actually, it is really fantastically huge in Britain right now. I mean, they've been sold out everywhere, and it made news stories all over the place. And that is, they're Tunnels. By two authors I'm not familiar with, Roderick Gordon and Brian Williams.
That's not an advance, is it? That's
yes, actual, it is.
It is an advance.
No, this is an advance copy because they're going to be printing it. Chicken House, which is an imprint of Scholastic, it's going to be coming out in January of 2008. Okay. Here in the U.S.
Gotcha.
And I think it'll also be really huge in the U.S. I'm only 30 pages or so into it. I just started it, but I am enjoying it. I have to say, my socks are not wowed off, but I just started it, so I will keep you posted on that. It's kind of steampunk-esque with archaeology, so like an archaeological adventure story with steampunk elements.
Dude, I want to read it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm enjoying it right now. So that, and then also because, you know, Halloween is close by, I finally picked up Heart-Shaped Box by Joe Hill, which, oh my god, OMFG. It's probably the scariest book I've ever read, and I'm only halfway through it. I'm terrified. I can't read big chunks of it at a time because it's utterly terrifying and my adrenaline is going. So
now, is it public that the author is that's a pseudonym?
Is that I don't know if that's public. I heard it in the store,
so maybe we shouldn't say
that. And I haven't fact checked.
Okay.
I would assume it's public if random employee was talking about it. The word is, may I?
Yeah, go for
it. Should we try
it?
But I haven't fact checked this, but I'm pretty sure it is true because I did get it from a decent source. Joe Hill is the author, and I believe that's the son of Stephen King. And this was his first novel, and it's incredibly good. If you guys like psychological thrillers, but also with a supernatural twist to it, it's both a ghost story and it just messes with your head completely. It's really, really good.
Nice.
Yeah.
Sounds like my kind of book. I actually really like Stephen King, and I used to read a lot of horror.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I think people are usually surprised when they hear that.
I am a little surprised.
I haven't read it in a while, though. Just kind of worked out of my system, you know, moved on to something else.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like I had friends who are parents now, and they're like, now that I have a kid, I can't read about things happening to kids and, you know, terribly frightening stories. I don't know. It changes their perspective on things. Do you think that's had anything to do with it?
No, because I stopped reading it long before my son was born.
Okay, well, I just pulled that completely out of my butt.
Yeah, I'm not going to touch that one. But I did want to squeeze something in here before we have to end this segment and get on to the interview, which was we've been releasing the conjecture interviews, but I just wanted to touch on it for a second. So we haven't actually recorded together since the convention. So I wanted to know what some of your favorite parts were about your experience there as a panelist. I'm interviewing you right now.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Should I give you the one word answer and drive you crazy?
Yeah.
Some of those people. Yeah, it was great.
Okay. I'm going to run 5 promos now.
No, it was a really great experience. It was completely nerve-wracking because I was on a panel with Howard Hendricks, and then I was on a panel with Werner Vinge, and then I was on a panel with Larry Niven. And so I was like, I don't know what to say to these people. These people are way smarter than I am. But I feel like I held my own and maybe contributed a bit. And they're all very nice. So
Yeah, they were. They make it easy.
They did.
They don't intimidate you with their intellect.
No, and it was a very small convention, and I liked it in that regard because it's like the audience was participating, and the panels were very informal, and so it took the pressure off.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like a completely pigeonholed, everything put in a box, everything has to be done exactly just so sort of thing. It was loosey-goosey, so.
Well, you know, I know that I was
Let me see how many metaphors I can just kind of throw out there.
Or cliches.
Yeah, or cliches, too.
Well, we were there because of the podcast.
Yes.
So I know I'm there because I'm a podcaster. But as someone who wants to be a writer, to be on panels with Werner Vinge, Howard Hendricks, in the Larry Niven interview, then I was on a panel with Tim Pratt, and you're going to have to help me if you recognize his name. Really nice guy, Greg Van Eckout. He's a short story writer, lives here in San Diego, and he introduced me, you know, said his name. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his last name properly, so I'm sorry, Greg, forgive me. Really nice guy, though. So to be on panels with those guys who have all achieved success in writing, won Hugo Awards and everything, was a very humbling experience for me.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as cool as it was for me, I also kind of went home in the evening feeling surreally out of place. surreally. Is that really a word?
Yeah. Yeah, I know the feeling, because I was just like, why am I on this panel?
Yeah.
With these people.
And I felt totally in place when I did the podcasting seminar, which went really well.
Yes, it did. You did a great job.
Oh, thank you. Because, you know, everyone was in the room to listen to me because I knew more about it than they did. You know, so I was like, I was actually the expert at that for that hour. Well, I did get some good feedback on the Larry Niven interview, so apparently people are enjoying it and thought that went well.
Good.
So, yeah.
Well done, sir.
Thank you. Speaking of interviews from Conjecture, we're going to take a little promo break and come back with Tim Pratt. We have some other things to share for you after that, so stick around.
TheNutGallery.com pledges to give you the best movie reviews. Reviews untainted by payoffs and unblemished by scandals. Listen to us before wasting your hard-earned money on a movie that sucks. Ah yes, truth, justice, and the American way. TheNutGallery.com way.
The material located in this podcast may not be appropriate for all audiences. The reviews and the works being reviewed may contain obscenity, nudity, whining, inane remarks, political incorrectness, and references to drugs and alcohol.
All right, and welcome back to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. And right now, I am sitting with freshly christened Hugo Award winner Tim Pratt. How are you doing, Tim?
Doing great. Sitting by the koi pond.
Now, you came down here just for Conjecture, right?
Well, my friend Greg Van Eekhout is down here. They recently moved from the desert, so we kind of wanted to visit them. And also, my wife is very pregnant. Our first baby is born later, near the end of October, so we figured it was kind of a last vacation, which we could write off on our taxes if we came to the convention. So, and they were kind enough to invite me, and it is the weekend that my book came out, Blood Engines, so it seemed like I should maybe do a little promotion before I have a squalling newborn in the house and all promotion stops.
So this is when life, art, and careers all come together as one.
That's right, exactly. And it would all be wonderful, except my book, Blood Engines, is the first in a four-book series, at least four books. I still have to write the fourth book. It's due in May. I've written three or four pages of it at this point, so it's going to be an interesting several months in my life coming up.
Now, how long does it normally take you to write a draft that's ready enough to send off to the editor?
It depends on how tight my deadline is. In a perfect world, I have, you know, a year, 8 months or so. With these books, they're coming out 6 months apart, which is great. They're trying to build an audience quickly, make sure that the first book is still on the shelf when the second book comes out, and so on, which is great. I'm thrilled they're doing it. It does mean the publication schedule is just gnarly. So the third book I wrote probably in about 2.5-3 months, and really intensely, I did nothing else. I mean, I just worked my ass off on it. So I actually haven't heard from my editor, so I can't tell you for sure that it worked, that I was able to write a successful book. I'm hoping that she thinks it's pretty good. My first readers seem to like it, so.
Well, is it a good sign if you don't hear right away?
It's a sign that she has a lot of other books to edit, I think, actually. In fact, she just got me the edits back to book two not that long ago, so the schedule is just, it's a very tight schedule. It's moving along, so I hope for the best.
Well, let's go ahead and jump into it. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your new book, which just came out?
Okay, well, Blood Engines features a character named Marla Mason, who's a sorcerer. And I've been writing about her for going on 10 years now. I wrote some short stories. Originally, the short stories were very dark, very horrific, inspired a lot by Nancy Collins, her Sonya Blue vampire series. I read that. You know, I sort of picked up the flavor and wanted to write some gritty, nasty, violent kind of stuff. And I wrote those stories, and they were fun. I actually found them a little too unremittingly dark. So gradually, as I wrote more about the character, more and more humor and sort of lightness and banter started to creep in, which is good because I couldn't do a four-book series of unrelenting darkness. So fortunately, there's some humor that's come in. The first novel in the series, Blood Engines, it has giant frog monsters and crazy Aztec zealots and guys who turn into bears and sex parties and the history of San Francisco and Emperor Joshua Norton and all sorts of interesting stuff. I moved out to California in 2000 and moved up to the San Francisco Bay Area from Santa Cruz in 2001 and kind of really fell in love with the place. Setting is often very important to me. My first book, The Strange Adventures of Ranger Girl, is largely a love song to Santa Cruz. And when I got up to San Francisco, started reading about the history, I wanted to write about that setting. But I didn't want it to be this treacly San Francisco's great, so I brought in this character, Marla Mason, who's from the East Coast, really hates San Francisco, is really annoyed that she's had to come out there. Basically, the plot is Marla is the chief sorcerer of this city on the East Coast, kind of a combination mob boss superhero, right? So she's there, she protects the city against supernatural threats, you know, incursions from interdimensional demons, great old ones rising from the sea, serial killers with magical powers, stuff like that is what she's in charge of stopping. In exchange, she owns a lot of property and runs some illegal rackets, and, you know, the mayor kind of looks the other way, and there's this whole sorceress secret underworld. Well, somebody in her city threatens her life, has a plot against her, and has a plot against her city. And in order to stop it, she needs this artifact. It's kind of your classic MacGuffin chase kind of thing. Let's set the plot in motion by making her get something. So there's this thing that she has to get to stop the plot, which requires her to come to San Francisco, where she is immediately stopped in her tracks. She can't get what she needs because there's this crazy guy who is a believer in the Aztec gods. He believes what the Aztecs believed, which was that the thing that keeps the planets and the sun moving in their orbits is blood, that the universe is lubricated with blood, that the universe is a great engine lubricated with blood, hence the name Blood Engines. And, you know, I try to leave it ambiguous in the book. Maybe he's right, you know? Maybe the Aztecs just spilled enough blood when in their days of doing mass human sacrifices. Things have kept running on that, but he thinks we really need to start mass human sacrifices again. He starts offing various sorcerers in San Francisco. Some of the sorcerers think Marla Mason is the one killing people. She kind of gets embroiled in it all, and hijinks ensue.
So where does this book rank on the graphic content scale from what I'm hearing?
There's a lot of hearts ripped out. There's not a ton of sex. There's a sex party that my main character has to crash. Kind of one of the things I had fun with is San Francisco has very distinct neighborhoods. There's the Tenderloin, which is sort of the scary, sketchy, it's a little more violent. A lot of the students live there because it's one of the only cheap places. It's a little crackhead filled. It can be scary. You know, there's North Beach, which is very Italian, and there's Chinatown, obviously, is legendary, and the Castro, which is known for its gay male population. So my kind of fun idea was that every neighborhood in San Francisco would have a sorcerer who sort of runs it. You know, so in the Tenderloin, it's kind of, she's kind of a nasty, tough, cannibalistic witch who runs the Tenderloin. The Castro is run by this guy, this sex magician or pornomancer, as my main character derogatorily calls him, who gets his energy from sex, and so he throws big sex parties. So that's about as graphic as it gets, her wandering around a sex party. And there's, you know, there's a fair bit of guys having their hearts scooped out with obsidian knives and things along those lines.
Nice. Well, you know, it's interesting with the fall season of television kicking off. I've noticed that some of the new science fiction shows coming out take place in San Francisco. There's Journeyman, I think Bionic Woman is in San Francisco, if I remember correctly. Yeah. What is it about San Francisco? Is it the geographic layout, the culture that makes it so supple, I guess that's the way to put it, for storytelling?
It's a really friggin' pretty city, which helps. It has, I think, really interesting geography. I mean, go back to something like Hitchcock's Vertigo. That's in San Francisco, right? You have the bridges. You have all the metaphorical stuff about islands and peninsulas and things being surrounded by water. You just have so many iconic things. You got the Golden Gate Bridge. You got Chinatown. You got Alcatraz, Japanese Tea Garden, all of which are in my book. Because when you have settings like that, you want to play with them, you know? Exactly. I mean, why wouldn't you? So I have, you know, mass murder at the Japanese Tea Garden. I have a really kind of creepy oracle that my people have to go consult on Alcatraz. I mean, some cool stuff.
And of course, we don't want to forget about Full House, right? Which classic San Francisco show. What is the distinction in your mind between writing supernatural fiction and fantasy fiction, or is there a difference at all? Is it just all the same?
To me, there's not a huge difference. Kind of the distinction, I write a lot of contemporary fantasy. I like magic set in the modern world, because I always enjoy that tension. To me, a dragon is cool. A dragon in Starbucks is even cooler, you know? A dragon destroying a Chevrolet dealership, to me, is much more interesting than a dragon destroying, you know, a little village with thatch huts. So the distinction I kind of make in the kinds of fantasy I write is that there are two kinds of fantasy. There's immersive fantasy, and there's intrusive fantasy. Immersive, intrusive. They sound really similar. I hope the distinction is clear. So in immersive fantasy, your characters know about magic. They're swimming in that environment. So in this series, pretty much all the main characters, they know about magic. They use magic. They kind of have to keep it on the down low. They keep it a secret. They don't want to freak people out. They don't want everybody knowing their secrets. So for me, that's kind of different, because mostly what I've written in the past is intrusive fantasy, where you have some ordinary person going about their life and magic intrudes. So that's a whole different kind of plot arc, right? To have your life upheaved and discover there's all these things I didn't know existed. And that's cool, and most of my stuff was like that. My first novel is like that. A lot of my short stories are like that. But so writing immersive fantasy for me was a little different. To have people who already know about magic, it requires a different set of protocols and a different kind of plot.
When you first started writing this character 10 years ago, did you have any idea that she would lead into four novels 10 years later?
I had no clue. You know, I'd written kind of a neat horror story called Harry Specs that I eventually published actually not long ago on a now-defunct webzine called Shadows of Saturn, where it was sort of this character kind of hard-edged as a mercenary fighting against a supernatural serial killer. I wrote that. I wrote another story called Pale Dog that nobody wanted to publish. I thought it was like the best, funniest story I'd written in ages. Nobody'd publish it. I finally put it in my first collection as the original novelette, and a lot of people dug it. A lot of people liked it. I had actually tried to write a novel about this character probably in like 98, 99 when I first started writing about her. I thought, hey, she's pretty cool. I'll write a whole novel about her. And I got about 50, 60,000 words, more than halfway through the book, and it just completely went off the rails. It just sucked. I'd bitten off way more than I could chew, and I had proliferating plot threads and stuff that made no sense and continuity errors, and it was like a house with a just rotten foundation. I couldn't even fix it. And actually, the core idea of that book wound up being book two in this series. I'd sort of thought, 10 years later, oh, there was a lot of good stuff in that book. I'll sell it on an outline, and I can probably just, fix it up a little. And I went back and actually wasted about 6 weeks trying to turn that mess into an actual novel. And eventually, I just had to start over from page one and keep some of the original kind of neat ideas about it, but not keep any of the original words. So, no, I actually had no idea. In fact, I thought this character was a failure for novels. But then I got this idea to take her out of her element and stick her in San Francisco. In a way, it's sort of weird to start a series about a character and have it not start in the setting that's going to be the main setting for all the other books. But I don't know. It somehow seemed to shake things up a little in my mind. Plus, you got some fish out of water stuff, It worked out well. But no, originally I had no idea that she would be a rich enough character for me to keep doing series books about.
Now, are you writing this series as a series of cliffhangers, or is each book self-contained? And you said it could maybe be more than four books?
Yeah, four books have been bought. If it does well and they want more, I actually have ideas for at least one more book after that. And, if they said, hey, write us four more, I'm not at all sick of the character. Part of doing a big series like this, one of the important things, I think, is to bring in a nice supporting cast, have enough extra characters that if necessary, if you get really sick of your main character, maybe you could shift the focus some. At this point, I'm not sick of the main character yet. As for whether they're cliffhangers or not at all, when I wrote Blood Engines, I intended it to be a standalone. And when I sold it, they said, well, could you write another one? Could you write a sequel? And I said, sure, I could write a second book. And then actually just earlier this year, after I turned in the second book, they said, we think this has series potential. How'd you like to do two more books in the series? So my original intention was to always make them standalone. I think the character does kind of develop and change. I think over the course of the series, we're going to see Marla Mason change from being a thug to a statesman. I mean, I kind of see that as her arc. Somebody who's really good at kicking people in the nuts right now is going to be somebody who has to learn how to deal with diplomacy and how to compromise. At this point, she still likes to solve all her problems with a vicious application of violence, Yeah, they pretty much stand alone. I do set up some stuff. Book four, actually, which is the one I'm about to start, her brother comes in, and I sort of have seeded little mentions of her brother through it. And like in the first book, I mentioned some characters who are important in the second book. In the second book, I mention offhand the guy who's like a major antagonist in the third book. So I am aware that I'm writing a continuing series, but the idea is very much to make each book. If you pick up book two, you don't need to really know anything about book one or book three to enjoy book two. So,
cool. I want to switch gears a little bit here and talk about Locus. You work for Locus. And could you tell us how long you've been there, what your responsibilities are, that kind of thing?
Sure. I started off working at Locus. I had moved up to Oakland in 2001 to be with my then-girlfriend, who's now become my wife, Heather Shaw. And had no job, was living in her place, didn't really know what I was going to do with my life, and I heard Locus was hiring. Of course, Locus is a trade magazine for the science fiction fantasy publishing field. They're up in the Oakland Hills. So I went up for an interview and actually got the job that day because my boss is close friends with one of my Clarion instructors. I went to Clarion in 1999. And so when I applied and said I'd been to Clarion, he sort of asked her, is this guy on the up and up? Is he okay? And she said, yeah, sure, he's great. You should hire him. So I got the gig. Initially, I was an editorial assistant. Starting off at Locus, there are certain things you do. You alphabetize books. You drive our editor-in-chief around on his errands. You know, you kind of muck out the stables, essentially. Over the years, I've been there ever since then, since 2001. I've risen to the high and gleaming rank of senior editor, and where I, let's see, last week I resurfaced the roof, so that was good. We're a small office, so everybody has to do a little bit of everything. In terms of magazine work, I do a lot of the layout, which I enjoy greatly. I love doing design, graphic design stuff. I do a lot of the layout. I am the guy who writes obituaries. I'm the guy who edits interviews. I write the intros for interviews, and I write a lot of the news. I don't write all the news, but I write a lot of it. So, yeah, it's a cool job, actually. If you have to have a day job, and if anybody out there would like to fund me to write full-time, I'd certainly be happy to cash your check. But if you got to have a day job, it's a pretty great day job for a writer to have.
How would you characterize Locus's importance to the science fiction field?
You know, Locus has, for years, been kind of the beating heart of the science fiction field. You know, we are the magazine of record. Pretty much anything of importance that happens in the field, we're the place that's going to report on all of it. And, you know, increasingly people are getting their news off the internet. Print magazines in general are struggling. But, you know, I think we put out a great magazine every month. I think we do our best to stay at the center of the field. You know, a lot of the younger people aren't as aware of Locus, which is a bummer. And something we're trying to do is to let people know that we're the social pages, we're the gossip pages, we're the news pages, we're the bibliographers. I mean, we compile bibliographies of everything published in the science fiction fantasy field. It's a huge resource. Every few months we do a forthcoming books issue where we look at all the books in science fiction fantasy, big presses and small presses that are coming out in the next few years, which booksellers, librarians love because they can look at it and say, holy crap, there's going to be another Terry Pratchett or a new Tim Powers or whatever. I think we're immensely valuable and people don't appreciate us enough, damn it.
Well, I'm a subscriber if that helps at all.
That does help. That helps immensely, yeah.
Yesterday in the panel, you made a comment about wondering whether or not print books are still a viable business model. And you just mentioned, again, the struggle of print magazines. Could you explain some more about that? That's a topic we talk about on this show, so what's your take on that?
Oh, holding me responsible for things I say on panels, that's cold. It was pretty much kind of a joke. Someone was, we were talking about whether electronic publishing was going to be viable in the long term, and I sort of said, I don't know if print publishing is going to be viable in the long term. And, I mean, you know, your listeners have, I'm sure, heard all this stuff before. Conglomeratization is a problem. Big companies are buying up small publishing houses. Imprints are getting slashed, editors get fired, there's an increasing insistence on the importance of the bottom line. You know, I've only been publishing novels for like a couple years. I've never known anything different. Part of working at Locus is that I know how bad we have it these days because I hear the stories of how it once was. And publishing's always been tough, but there was a time when you could kind of build a career. You know, it was okay if your first few books didn't do that great. The publisher was interested in building your career slowly and letting an audience develop. And I mean, I have friends who sell 3 books, 4 books, and that's it. You know, they're stuck. They can't sell their next one. They have to go to the small press. Fortunately, there are still vibrant, thriving small presses. Nightshade Books is one in particular that's picked up a lot of great authors who, for whatever reason, got dumped from the big presses.
And you have a book through Nightshade.
I do. I have a collection. It's, you know, unless you're Stephen King or Charles DeLint or somebody like that who has a really strong novel audience, the big publishers just aren't likely to do a collection of books. Chiny Mieville did a big press collection, but the people who do collections through the major publishers are totally the exceptions. So small presses, the thing is, Nightshade Books, if they sell, you know, just a couple few thousand of my book, it's a success. It's a hit for them. Whereas a big publisher, my editor, would get fired if I sold that few. So yeah, Nightshade, I think, does beautiful work. I was really happy. My collection, Heart and Boot and Other Stories, came out just in February. And from what they told me, it's in the black. It's doing well. So that's nice.
Well, when you have publishers like Nightshade or smaller presses and they're doing well, would you recommend that newer authors try to get in with these smaller publishers first before ever even thinking about getting into the bigger ones? Or because they print fewer books, is it just as difficult to get published by small press?
The small press's Nightshade, I know, is getting a lot more selective. What I would recommend for new authors is shoot for the moon. You know, try and whoever your favorite, whoever publishes the books you love the most, whoever, you know, whichever agent reps the authors you love the most, those are the places you should be trying to get into. And, you know, if you can't sell your books through them, you know, it sort of depends on the feedback. If the feedback you're getting is sort of, no, we don't think you're ready for prime time, maybe accept that you're not ready for prime time and write more. If the feedback is, well, I just don't think I could market, or this is a really cool idea, but it's too quirky, or it's just not something that we think would do well in today's publishing climate or whatever, then I think going to the small presses is absolutely viable. And if you have a book that you really believe in, try and send it out. You know, send it to Nightshade.
Okay, we have to talk about the Hugo Award. Woo! Before I let you go, because I've got a little bit of time for your panel. How does it feel? Tell us about the experience of learning that you won the Hugo Award, and tell us a little bit about the story that won the award.
The story is called Impossible Dreams. It was in Asimov's. It actually won the Asimov's Reader Poll, which surprised me. It's a sweet love story. It's kind of a romantic comedy about this guy who loves movies and is not so good at the social things, who discovers a little magic shop. For years, I wanted to write a little magic shop story. Every time I tried to write them, they were dumb and derivative and like every other magic shop. So I thought it'd be fun to do a magic video store where, you know, you go to this store and there are movies that were never made here. You know, the director's cut of The Magnificent Ambersons by Orson Welles is there. You know, Tim Burton's Superman is there. Harlan Ellison's screenplay of I, Robot got made into a feature film, things like that. Movies that just, because Hollywood is littered with the wreckage of movies that almost got made, didn't quite get made. Movies where Citizen Kane wasn't the first movie that Orson Welles did, stuff like that. So I have this little magic shop story. A guy goes in and discovers all this stuff and meets, you know, the clerk of the store who has no idea that she's part of this magical world, because for her it's totally normal. For her, a world where Citizen Kane was made is an amazing kind of world. So that's the story. Winning the Hugo was messed up. Well, I sent a speech. My friend Paul Melko, who's a great writer, was also a nominee. Went to Japan. I couldn't go to Japan because my wife is now 8 months pregnant, and then what is 7 months in international travel and 7 months pregnant, they don't go. Wasn't going to go without her, so I sent a speech. It was kind of a short speech because I didn't think Melko would have to read it. I thought there was no chance I would win. I was up against Neil Gaiman, who's what? Won the last 3 times he's been nominated or something? I thought I was going to be stomped to dust. And honestly, the ballot was strong otherwise. Ben Rosenbaum had a great story. I didn't even think I'd come in second, to be totally honest. So, you know, the ceremony was held in Japan. It was going to be start at like 1 a.m. or something in Pacific time in California where I was. I didn't even stay up. I just went to bed because I didn't think it mattered. I figured, oh, tomorrow I'll see, you know, that Neil won. And nobody called me or anything. So I get up in the morning and check my email. And the first email that comes down is a message from John Scalzi. And it's one word: congratulations. More emails appeared and I discovered I'd actually won the Hugo. So to call me shocked would be rather an understatement. But it was fun. My friend Susan Grappi, who's the editor-in-chief, was having a party that night anyway. So it kind of became a celebration party for me. They bought me a bottle of champagne, and I got really wasted. And, you know, my first time nominated for a Hugo, I'm stunned that I won, and incredibly flattered and really delighted. And now I never have to worry about the Hugo ever again because I won one. Now I just need a Nebula, World Fantasy Award, International Horror Guild Award, a Tiptree. There's still places to go, but I'm pretty happy with the Hugo.
Well, can you tell us how you think the Hugo Award will change your career from this moment forward?
Yeah, I'm not sure, actually, since the main project I'm doing now is this urban fantasy series, which is actually under the name T.A. Pratt, because they're trying to brand it very separately from my sort of short fiction stuff. Because the audience for the kind of urban fantasy that I accidentally wrote, you know, I just wrote the kind of shit I always write, and my editor and agent said, whoa, this is in a recognizable subgenre that's kind of doing well. They were quite happy. The audience is really not really the science fiction audience. You know, they're not necessarily, the bulk of them aren't people who really care about science fiction. They don't know what the Hugo is. They're largely romance readers, paranormal romance kind of readers. That's a lot of the people that we're trying to court. So slapping a sticker that says Hugo Award winner really wouldn't mean that much to them. So I don't think they're going to bother. What they want, of course, is for people, the tiny handful of people who know who Tim Pratt is, they want them to come and read the T.A. Pratt books. The T.A. Pratt people, you know, that audience, it's okay if they don't know who Tim Pratt is, really. You know, it's not probably what they're really looking for. I mean, these are the people who love Kim Harrison, Kelly Armstrong, and who have been great to me. They gave me great blurbs, have been really welcoming. Kim Harrison, especially, who's a huge bestseller, has been incredibly nice, invited me onto her mailing list to talk to all her fans, and it's been a great experience.
Do you still want to write science fiction under Tim Pratt?
Yeah, stuff that's not in the series. It's not. It's really just a branding thing. It's like Charles DeLint writes horror novels as Samuel M. Key. You know, Ian Banks writes nonfiction or writes mainstream books as Ian M. Banks. It's just sort of more of a signifier to say if it's T.A. Pratt, it's about this character in this world. It's this kind of story. You know, I would certainly imagine I would still publish other novels as Tim Pratt, I hope, if people will buy them. Short stories, I think, unless they're set in that world, are still going to be Tim Pratt. So I just have a split personality, that's all.
Well, it seems like more and more authors are doing that just for the book scan, the tracking of the titles.
That's right. If a Tim Pratt book didn't do so well, a T.A. Pratt book, well, maybe they won't know. I try not to poke or ask too many probing questions of my editor. You know, maybe there's some things I don't want to know.
Well, Tim, it's been great having you on the show. Thanks for making the time for us.
I really appreciate you having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Nanotechnology, global warming, artificial intelligence, the singularity, stem cell research, space exploration. Will humanity survive? Are you curious about the future? The Future in You is a Parsec award-winning podcast by science fiction author Stephen Ewan Cobb. Join him as he explores the future with scientists, doctors, researchers, and best-selling authors of science fiction and fantasy.
But I do think the conquering and reversing of aging is a real possibility.
I don't have a gun. Never have, never will. But I believe that, you know, if you want to buy a gun, you have a right to. Mm-hmm.
And we've got to teach kids to think for themselves, and we don't do that.
Past guests include Greg Bear, Alan Dean Foster, Mike Resnick, Werner Vinge, Kim Stanley Robinson, and many, many more. From the next tick of the clock to the ultimate end of the universe, every subject is fair game. Subscribe today at www.thefutureandyou.com. The future is coming. Will you be ready for it?
And welcome back to the show. Once again, I would like to thank Tim for taking time out of his convention to sit down with me in that little kind of wooded nature-like thing they created in the hotel. You know, that place with the ravine and all the trees.
The Hawaiian waterfalls.
Yeah, that's where we were.
You felt like you were in Oahu.
Exactly. So I don't know if you can hear the water in the background or not, but there was a stream right next to us. So thanks, Tim. That was a lot of fun. Okay, let's talk about some of the feedback that we got from the last episode that we actually did together, which would have been episode 34.
Something.
I believe. And Eat Crow. I guess Eat Crow is one of them.
Yeah, Eat Crow.
We some people called us out very nicely, I might add. But they called us out when we said, and I started this, that romance books suck.
Controversy.
Yeah. And then we went on to insult literary people who say that science fiction sucks and just dismisses it right after we had just dismissed romance books.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know what? You guys caught us. But having said that and admitting it and that I should be a little bit more open-minded than that, I'm sure that there is one good romance book a year.
Well, I think I actually thought of this at the time when we were recording it, but I think what I was saying, let me clarify, because I did not post on the site. I'm sorry, I didn't really have time to compose my thoughts to do so. So I'm going to just kind of ramble on here. Ha ha. And you have to listen to me. Wahaha. literature, I think, is the key phrase here is literature. Now, romance can be a really fun read and can be, you know, kind of candy and popcorn and something to take your mind off. Escapism, great escapism. But really, how much is it literature? Science fiction, good science fiction, expands the mind. Exposes you to whole new concepts and ideas that you would never have thought of.
Not new sexual positions.
Yeah, precisely. Where it's like, romance, does it do that? I don't think so. And there is some science fiction that's totally popcorn, that doesn't expand your mind, and I wouldn't necessarily call that literature. I would say it's a fun read, but I wouldn't call it literature. So I think that's the key thing to discern here, is when it comes to literature, how much of romance is actually literature. Now, you do get some historical fiction-y romance, and maybe more so because you're learning about history in it. But
there's a difference between romance and romantic elements, too.
Yes, precisely. And, so, I mean, you know, like I was talking about the Stephanie Meyer books, and those definitely have romantic elements.
And the Diana Gabaldon.
Yeah, exactly.
Diana.
And even as much as I love the Stephanie Meyer books, I don't know if I'd call that literature, per se. It's a little more popcorn-y. But it's very enjoyable, and I highly encourage people to read it. I think that's the difference in my mind, as far as people who are in the world of literature and they dismiss science fiction, they exclude it from literature because they think it's just fun and popcorn. Whereas really, it's one of the most thoughtful and mind-expanding things you can read. The end.
I'm with you.
Okay.
So, yeah, I understand where, and I appreciate that the people came on the blog and said what they did.
I absolutely did.
I thought it was great.
For sure.
So, but I think our point is clear now.
Maybe, yeah, and people, so, I'm sure, will still disagree with us, and then you can log back onto the blog and tell us that we're full of S.
And tell Sam that she is.
And then I can say, well, I don't think I am, and neener, neener, and then we can kiss and make up.
There you go.
And I won't slip you the tongue.
Virtually.
Unless you want me to.
That's what you said to me last time.
I know, I'm sorry. I just can't control myself around when I'm around you, Sean.
I know. A lot of women have that trouble. All right, so moving on now. Sam, guess what? You're supposed to say what, Sean?
What, Sean?
That's right. This month, and a long time listeners will know this, is the 1 year anniversary of this show.
Yay!
How about that, huh? So we are on episode, well, this number-wise is episode 37, but in the early days, I did 4 special editions that were not numbered in the actual count. Okay. So really, there have been 41 episodes of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing since October 2006. Add on that to the fact that I performed and produced the Silk Code novel, an 80,000-word novel for Paul Levinson, which was 22 episodes. I've actually done 63 podcasts in the last year.
Yikes.
Which may explain why my ears feel like they're about to fall off. And why these headphones are falling apart.
Yeah, they literally are. They leave like nasty black crumbs
dust
on Sean's head every time he wears them. It's really hot.
So I decided that I'm going to go ahead and celebrate this milestone. And the way I'm going to celebrate is to take a break. So this is a big announcement for you folks out there. And this isn't necessarily the best timing to take a break, considering the fact that we just joined Farpoint Media. But I am feeling burned out.
Yeah.
Just flat out burned out. And I just need to step back for a month or two and get life back in order, so to speak. So this will be the last episode that Sam and I do together before this break, or before we come back, probably in December.
This is where you guys go, aww.
Yeah, not that we'll be able to hear you. Come on the blog page and put aww comments on there.
With a sad face.
But there are going to be 2 more interview-only episodes after this. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm not going to be working on the podcast before you hear us again in December, because I have new segments to get ready for you guys and a new program to learn how to use. So I'm still going to be working. I don't know how much of a break this is really going to be. Yeah, I need a little bit of a break. So that's what we're going to do.
Well, unfortunately, this is your hobby, and you shouldn't get burned out on your hobbies. So I encourage you to take this break. I'm sorry, folks. I'll miss the show. I have fun doing this. But we'll be back. So please do not erase us from your, you know.
Yeah, don't unsubscribe to the feed.
Yeah, please. Because we'll be back, and then we'll be better than ever.
And I may drop a bonus thing, one thing or two in there during the break, too. If someone's at Mysterious Galaxy and I just record their segment and it's really cool,
yeah,
then I might throw it in there as a little extra thing. But please stay subscribed. If you're a new listener and this is the first time you've heard us, then this is a good chance for you to kind of catch up on some of the older episodes. If you want to look on our backlist at the website, or in the iTunes store and see what authors we've had on the show, which shows you might like to listen to. Now's a good time to do that. And we will be back with, and we already have a lineup started.
Great.
I already have interviews I'm going to be doing during this time. So it's going to be good when we come back.
Well, I'm looking forward to returning. And until we see you, folks, have good holidays. Eat lots of candy and eat turkey.
Yeah, we might. I'm not going to commit to a date that we'll be back. But okay. We won't be gone forever. We'll be back in the near future. Last thing to cover in this show is the Michael Moorcock book giveaway contest is complete as of the release of this episode, not as of the recording of this episode. So I can't announce the winners because we're recording this on a Tuesday, even though I'll release it on Friday. So next time in the interview only episode, I will announce the winner in the intro. Okay. So thank you to everyone who has been entering. It's been really cool to see.
I know. I'm so glad to see all this feedback.
And the emails and stuff. Yeah, that's cool.
Thanks, folks.
And thanks again to Lou and Pyre. Go buy books from Pyre.
Exactly.
Voicemail 206-350-50... What is it? 5029. Give us a call. We haven't had a voicemail in a long time, even though, of course, now I'm not going to have a show to put the voicemail in. So save up your voicemails and call us when we come back.
Well, you can call us and say, I miss you.
Yeah, if you call, we will still play them when we come back on. So please give us a call.
And then you'll give us the warm fuzzies, too.
Which always is always good. Yeah. Yes. And then adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com and adventuresinscifipublishing.com. For Sam, my name's Sean, and we'll see you when we come back from the break.
Keep reading.
Music for Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing by Cargo Cult from their song Dirt. You can learn more about them at magnatune.com. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to a Singularity Audio production. To learn more, please visit www.singularityaudio.com.